I was thinking actually of an evening in a church outside the UN just before the war started 5 years ago. It's actually about a month before, and a number of people, in fact, nearly all priests and ministers and nuns and rabbis, people of faith, they were announced, actually were planning to get arrested at the UN, U.S. Delegation to the UN the next day to protest our coming war against Iraq, which seemed clearly would be against the UN Charter and our commitments to international law. It would be an act of aggression without approval or authorization by the UN Security Council, which it was already clear was not going to be forthcoming. So it would be a clear crime against the peace, a war of aggression, what's been called the supreme war crime, which encompasses all the others, and which was the main charge, conspiring to a crime against the peace, which was the main charge for which people were hanged at Nuremberg after the Second World War. And in the church before that, there was a very, the night before the action, there was a very moving set of testimonies and people talking about the war. A lot of people were there, some of whom were going to take part in the action and some were not. And they were, a woman was coming around and passing around a clipboard for you to put your name down if you were going to be arrested the next day. And so for lawyers' benefit, there were a couple of us there who were not ministers or priests or anything, sort of ringers there for peace, like Ben Cohen, for example, of Ben and Jerry's, and a few others. And so the woman came around with the clipboard, handed it to me and said, "Are you a person of faith?" And that I had to think, you know, for a minute. I said, "Well, I don't know if I'm a person of faith, but I'm a person of hope." And I might mention, by the way, that there were a lot of people in this action. I don't know if I should tell this in public or not, but in this group, I'm sure I can. We were crowded into this thing, into a holding cell after the action. A lot of people that I knew already, and but some that I didn't know. And there was one guy, quite nicely dressed person like everybody else there. Everybody was in their collars and everything for the day. And so he came up and shook hands in the cell, and he introduced himself. I didn't know the name. And he said, and I said, what do you do? He said, "I'm the General Secretary of the American Communist Party." I said, "Wow, you are a person of faith." I'd never known. Life had never brought me into contact with the General Secretary of the American Communist Party anymore. And one thing that gives me hope is the persistence of concepts such as are represented by the War and Law League. The emphasis here, which is described, I notice, as wanting the U.S. to follow its constitution, its treaties, and customary international law. It says customary international law, by the way, insofar as they concern war and peace. The U.N. Charter is not customary international law. The U.N. Charter is a treaty signed by the United States, ratified by the United States Congress, which has the status of highest law of the land, along with the Constitution. That means it trumps state legislation and so forth. An international signed treaty is obligatory on us. And if I would say there's one thing a little missing from some of the literature that I got back at the table there about Gaul, which I recommend you reading in detail, I've just read it over again myself, is that it doesn't always mention that Congress, since 1945, even if it votes in both houses by an overwhelming majority for a war, does not, by that act, make the war legal. Congress cannot make legal a war of aggression in violation of the UN Charter. And if Congress was, of course, manipulated with a good deal of compliance on their part and chosen ignorance, but they were manipulated and lied to into supporting this war 5 years ago, including, of course, two of the candidates for president now, right now. But even if, it, with full information, they had decided that this was a war the U.S. should engage in, they would then be complicit in a war of aggression and would be subject, I would suppose, to a war crimes trial as much as anybody else, including our leaders, if you can imagine that coming before an international criminal court. I believe, for example, now quite clearly that the actions by this administration to withdraw from any jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, which they explained as protecting sergeants and privates and troopers in general from prosecution by some biased national court other than American, that that was a cover, that they knew, we know now that they were planning a war of aggression against Iraq at that time. And although I'm sure they weren't worried about being called before a court, they weren't worrying about being occupied and arrested and having to hide in spider holes and being found and dragged before the court. They're not worried about that, and they shouldn't be worried about that as long as they stay in this country. They didn't want the indictment. They didn't want the question to be raised by others and to admit that they were fugitives from justice, let's say, as early as that. Now, Cheney, Bush, others had no intention of going to Congress. That was Powell's great achievement, was to urge them, after all, to have a congressional resolution and to go to the UN and seek an agreement. But one thing was very clear. The lack of an agreement was not going to keep Bush and Cheney from launching that war. And it didn't keep Powell either, if it comes to that. So somebody noticed, my friend Ray McGovern had a very interesting commentary on the Frontline series last week, the two-part, six-hour program on Bush's war. How many people saw a part of that? Yeah, well, as far as it went, it was interesting. It wasn't much new in it, if you've been following this. But it was an interesting compilation of clips about the lies and the incompetence and so forth, and a number of commentaries from people. But as McGovern pointed out, essentially no one on those 6 hours commentary on the war commented on the fact that it was an illegal war. There was implications that Congress was deliberately lied to, although they didn't make a great point of that. And when I relate this to the material in Wall, it is mentioned in their literature that it's in violation of the UN Charter, but I noticed a number of the other pages, I would just make this point, emphasize almost exclusively your focus on the constitutional issue, which is indeed very important, but it's only part of the problem. And the other part is, as I say, law that has become far more than customary law. In fact, it's not very customary. But the UN Charter law, which says without authorization of the UN Security Council, which of course is subject to veto by the nuclear powers, the main nuclear powers, the war is a crime against the peace, unless it's in response to an immediate armed attack before the UN can meet. And that's the same exception that's in the Constitution and has always been there, that the president has the power to repel immediate attacks on U.S. forces, which of course was not an issue at all in the case of Iraq. But that Congress constitutionally must make that decision. Now, the documents that I do recommend to you again by Wald show the not only the Constitution, but the statements of the writers of the Constitution at the time, making clear they knew very well why they were vesting the power to move from peace to war, not just to declare war, which perhaps unfortunately are the words in the Constitution. But the commentary makes it very clear at the time and after that the founders said in so many words, the change from peace to war is to be made not with the consent of Congress, not with the advice of Congress, not with a shared decision by the President and Congress, exclusively by the legislature, not by the Commander-in-Chief. He does not participate in that power except to repel sudden attacks and to carry out the making of war. Now, not very many Americans have this in their minds at all after the last almost 60 years now. I can say that as a young man in 1950, what was I, 19. I admired Harry Truman on the whole at that time. I was certainly a Democrat. And I was rather proud of the fact that we had were carrying out, it seemed, the World War II ideal, which had been drummed into me as a boy growing up in World War II, of repelling aggression, collective defense against aggression. It seemed clear at the time that there was North Korean aggression at that point, and I thought the idea of repelling it was a good idea. And it was described, of course, as a UN action, partly because Russia was boycotting at that moment the UN, and it was possible to get a UN support of that. But the point I wanted to focus on, that, as your literature here points out, was the start of a clear-cut, explicit precedent by Harry Truman that the president did not need any role of Congress in sending troops into Congress, into battle, into combat. And at the time, Senator Robert Taft was one of those who was known as Mr. Republican, and the most prominent Republican, the man who felt that the nomination for president in 52 had been sort of stolen from him by Eisenhower, strongly condemned that and said, this is a very bad precedent, this is unconstitutional, Congress will rue the day, and so forth, and it sort of sounded like Senator Morse in 1964 with reference to the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. Well, not only did I pay no attention to what Robert Taft said at the time, but I would have thought of that as a very bad support. I didn't like Taft at all. I was interested in labor economics at that time. I had in mind being a labor, I was studying labor in college. Economics, I was going to be a union organizer or a labor economist. And Robert Taft was kind of a demon in my book from the Taft-Hartley Act. Truman was good. Truman vetoed Taft-Hartley and was overridden. Truman was wrong. Taft was right on that. I was wrong at that time in 19. And it took me a while to discover that. But in years, it took actually being in a real war eventually in Vietnam. Korea was a real war, and actually I enlisted the Marines during the Korean emergency, but I didn't get sent to Korea. That precedent was very, very costly constitutional. And not just because a world of law is a good thing, which it is on the whole, and we should obey laws and this and that, but because the founders of the Constitution had a very good idea. That was a very good constitutional principle. As far as I know, it was an invention of the founders, and in direct reaction to what they saw as world history up till that time, and very specifically the practice of the empire of which we were part under the kings. They very clearly did not want a king defined very largely by his power to declare, not only to declare, but to raise armies and carry forth war on one person. And as they said over and over, no one person, not just a British monarch or whoever, no person, no American should be entrusted with the power in one person or a small group of people to decide to go to war. And they gave lots of reasons for that. And their reasons were all good, they were all sound, and that was a wonderful idea. And that, as they put it, the decision to go to war should be vested in a large body of relatively representative people, not just the Senate, by the way, but had to be concurrent, Senate and House majorities. It would make it less likely to go to the kinds of wars that kings were prone to, wars of pride, wars of aggrandizement, wars that the public didn't need and didn't want, that were not just, in a word. Not impossible, but less likely than if you vested that power in one man, as in practice the US of A is now doing, pretty much. What we have come to is very close to an abrogation of Article 1, Section 8, of the Constitution. And I go back to the point, my focus on that is not just that, gee, it's the Constitution, hallowed, we ought to think about it, but rather that was a brilliant, profound invention in world history. It deserves to be struggled for us to keep it. And that means to get back to it. And that'll take a lot of doing. That'll take a lot of doing. We should have the legal profession, the judges, the law scholars, the lawyers in general, the law students, should be focusing on the legal aspects, the illegal aspects, I should say, of what is being done in our name in a variety. And of course, the war is an egregious one, but not the only one, the Iraq War. We have an administration right now that is committing crimes that are not unprecedented. Most of the crimes they're committing in the way of illegal warrantless wiretaps and of signing statements in some cases, various other things, have been done by other presidents. But in the case of Johnson, who did them, in the case of Nixon, in the case of Johnson, we didn't discover that he was using CIA and NSA on a big program of illegal warrantless wiretaps against the anti-war movement and others, the Black Panthers and others, and until he was out of office. So the issue of prosecuting or impeachment didn't arise while he was in office. Whether the Democrats in a majority would have been any more willing to impeach him than the Republicans are to impeach Bush is a question. But they weren't challenged to do that because the information was kept secret by thousands and thousands of people who knew about the crimes inside the government and kept their jobs and their clearances by keeping their mouths shut at the time. Nixon, again, was repeating many of these crimes, some of them against me. So happens, warrantless wiretapping against me, CIA agents come to beat me up or kill me on the May 3rd, 1972. Burglary into my doctor's office to get information with which to blackmail me into keeping my mouth shut. Those did come up while he was still in office. And because they were clearly illegal at that time, they, as well as unconstitutional, he was in trouble. And he faced impeachment, actual impeachment hearings, and finally was forced to resign facing impeachment. Interestingly, a number of Republicans joined that. That was a bipartisan thing at that time. They rose to the challenge of enforcing the law in a way that Republicans are egregiously not doing now, to their great shame. It's not only the Democrats letting off on the whole, and the leadership letting off Bush, which is inexcusable, in my opinion, we shouldn't let the Republicans off the hook. They are allowing this criminality to go on, too, because it's being done by a member of their own party. We have a situation, though, now where for 7 years, it turns out, the president has been blatantly violating a law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which was passed precisely in the wake of the revelation of Nixon and Johnson's lawbreaking here, to make it very specific and to set up procedures for dealing with wiretaps in a way that would preserve secrets, and not a very good way constitutionally, actually. The FISA court is pretty close to being a rubber stamp, but it does at least preserve the notion that the executive alone is not to be trusted to make the decision on whether all of our electronic communications are to be listened to by the government. There has to be a, to some extent, independent branch of government, the judiciary, involved in that decision. That's the point about the warrant. And even though, as I say, on the whole, they have rubber-stamped nearly every request that's been made, still they must have had some restraining effect, or the president would not have chosen to ignore the court and the law for 7 years, just ignored. I'm sure he had a very good reason for that, meaning it wasn't just convenience. It means that if we could find out, and here Congress has totally abrogated its responsibilities, to find out what NSA, the National Security Agency, has actually been doing in the way of surveillance, they have in no way, they've ignored their oversight responsibilities, and they have ignored their sworn oath to uphold the Constitution, because this surveillance in particular clearly violates not only the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, a clear piece of legislation meant to block what the president is doing, warrantless surveillance of Americans, but it clearly is in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. It virtually writes it out. Now, I mentioned that all these things, and I was overheard on warrantless wiretaps, all these things were clearly illegal under Nixon, then FISA was, well, I mean, they were, let's say, a little less clearly legal. FISA was enacted in 78 in order to make the illegality even more clear. But it was clear enough that he kept it totally secret. Lied to my court as to whether I'd been overheard until finally, effectively a leak revealed it. Illegal then. Of course, going into my doctor's, okay, legal now, at least it was until recently, now it's up in the air this month, by the Protect America Act, which Congress, a Democratic Congress, under the leadership of Nancy Pelosi, shamefully passed in August of last year. But as in the case of war, notice, this is unconstitutional. Congress can't abrogate the Fourth Amendment by a majority vote of Democrats or Republicans. There is a process for amending the Constitution in this age of terror and nuclear weapons and everything else, but it's a rather complicated process and it involves a lot of legislatures and people. Congress can't just write a law and say, oh, well, now it's all right to violate the Fourth Amendment. But they did that, giving at least the president a case to go into in court with in court. Torture, clearly illegal, again, on general international law principles and treaties that we have signed and domestic laws that have been passed, and more than one, blatantly illegal. And that is not only waterboarding, it's the whole slew of cruel, inhumane, and decent procedures that they've been following, not only waterboarding, which has been going on for 7 years now and is still going on. So the president now, having been found out by leaks, as in Abu Ghraib and others, and on the NSA, which came out through leaks to the New York Times, which the New York Times inexcusably held on to for a full year before publishing. But that did come out in December 2005. That was over 2 years ago. And that surveillance is still going on. So we have a situation here of a president who has not only acted, but really proclaimed through people like Cheney and his chief of staff, David Addington, a counsel who has written the advice on supposedly justifying torture, signing statements that abrogate legislation, the president's inherent powers as commander-in-chief for the surveillance and for starting wars. He's written all that. Their theory is a rather coherent legal theory that in this age, dangerous age, the country needs a president, a leader, who has total freedom from second guessing by the Congress, from advice, from constraint, from prosecution, from court orders, anything from the Constitution, who is not constrained by the Constitution, not constrained by laws or by international laws, the UN Charter, for example. That is their theory and has been so, and Addington has written to that extent, and he's still there, for 30 years now, since Cheney was in the Congress and was already acting as a congressman on views he formed in the Nixon and Ford White House. And those views were that Nixon should not have been investigated or criticized or potentially impeached or prosecuted for any of those things that he did, that Nixon as president had the legitimate power to do everything that Nixon did do and everything that Bush is doing now. That is their theory of government of the people in the White House. Now, that's a theory. They have a right to that theory. They have a right to say that's the way it should be, like any American can say that. They don't have a right to act on that as people who have sworn an oath to uphold the Constitution as written and the laws as written and faithfully to execute the laws. Every member of the armed forces, I'm sorry, every officer in the armed forces, and every member of the Congress, and every official in government has sworn the same oath. A little surprising, military and civilians are all the same, and the legislature all the same. None of them, even the ones who work for the president in the or the commander-in-chief in the military, none of them take an oath to obey the commander-in-chief. That's what the Nazi army under Hitler did. They swore a blood oath to the Führer. And first the SS did it, and then it was extended to all the officers. And a lot of them took that quite seriously, even a number who felt that what was happening was disastrous and wrong, and actually did feel specifically bound by their oath of honor to the Führer, to the leader. Führer means leader. That's the theory of Addington, Cheney, Bush, I guess, has been educated into this, and a number of other lawyers who work for them. Almost no lawyer in the country outside the executive branch or who has worked for the Bush executive branch believes that. It is the theory of the theorists of the Nazi power, people like Carl Schmitt, earlier a theorist of Mussolini's, a major law scholar of Mussolini's powers, and then that was taken over by Nazi Germany. It is not the theory of our former government. It's a different constitution, if you like, and you don't get a different constitution in theory, in law, by electing a different president. It's not the constitution they have sworn to uphold. I mentioned that none of them take an oath to the Führer, nor do they take an oath to secrecy. They sign a lot of secrecy agreements. I did that, but they don't raise their right hand and say, on honor, so help me God, I will never reveal. They take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, Addington and Cheney and Bush are, I would say, in the most clearest sense, domestic enemies of the Constitution. And that calls to have them as president or as your boss or as the leader of the executive branch, if you're a congressperson, or as your commander-in-chief, confronts you potentially, or it should confront you, with a real challenge. It's not enough to disagree with them or to condemn them or to criticize them. Your sworn duty is to resist that, to uphold the Constitution. The military have not been doing that. They are subject to the UCMJ, the Universal Code of Military Justice. It's a little different from justice or from the Bill of Rights. The civilians in particular, though, are not subject to that. The civilians who keep their mouths shut, as I did for years, about what they know are unconstitutional actions or criminal actions, are violating their oath of office. They think of themselves often as upholding, as acting honorably because they're obeying their agreement to keep secrets. And they do often consider the president, as I did for a long time, as the maker of foreign policy. I didn't know much about the Constitution. I didn't know this history that's in the Wall documents. And I worked for the president. I didn't think the Constitution applied to me particularly, or the president. He made foreign affairs. Well, that was wrong. And many of them still do believe that. A few, like Lieutenant Ouattara, take seriously their oath of the Constitution and simply refuse to take part in an illegal war, knowing that that was probably going to put him in prison, which, fortunately, it hasn't so far. I would say he's the only officer I know in the U.S. Armed Forces who's taken seriously his or her oath to uphold the Constitution, or at least who has thought about it enough to realize that that is not synonymous with obeying the president. If our former government has one founding principle, isn't it that? There's several, no doubt, but that would be among the small set, that being loyal to this country, loyal to the Constitution, loyal to the ideals and principles of this country, is not synonymous with obeying the Führer, with obeying any one man, the president. He doesn't make the law, and she doesn't make the law, if we get a female. And she can violate it, and if in so doing must be disobeyed and resisted and exposed. so forth. Well, Wall now for 10 years has been making this point, and with fewer allies than I wish they had, but it's a noble, important effort. The effort to get back to these constitutional principles and the idea of a government of law, a government of laws, not men. Interestingly, Cheney is enough knowledgeable of that point, I've read in some memoirs, to have explicitly said after 9/11, it looks like this will have to be a government of men for a while. And for a while means till the end of the war on terror. That goes well beyond our lifetimes or our children's lifetimes or maybe our grandchildren's lifetimes. But in other words, he knew the difference. He'd heard of it and he made his choice. Now, to have ruled impeachment off the table is very like ruling the Constitution off the table. And I want to repeat over and over, I mean, I have repeated, I'll say it again. The Constitution was no perfect document, and nor did the people who wrote it think it was. They wrote it in a way, as Obama has just reminded us, by the way, in his good speech on race, to seek, I think the word is, a more perfect union, a process. They allowed for amendment. They allowed for impeachment, among other things. And they allowed for amendment. And there have been some very useful amendments. You can't call the Constitution perfect that enshrined slavery, provided support for slavery. And that wasn't the only problem. There's lots of problems with the Constitution, and I come back to the notion, but it had some very good principles in it that were new and not just lip service, such as the one I've been describing here, that are absolutely worth taking very seriously. I come back to this deadline thing. It is worth seeing. I didn't see all of it, and I plan to see all of it on the computer, but as Ray McGovern, and you can look that up on Truth Out, I think, and Common Dream, several places. Ray McGovern's critique on ewar.com, that it simply ignores the point about law is worth keeping in mind as you look at it. That's the dimension that Wall adds to this national discussion. And it's very, very important, despite the fact that most Americans don't care about it. Most Americans don't care about civil liberties, polls show. They don't care very much, and they don't care about law. And the idea of even addressing the question of whether the Iraq attack was legal did not even arise in our national discussion before the war in any significant way at all. That's a difference from some other countries, interestingly. Britain, the mother country from whom we separated in part so we wouldn't have a king. And so we would have a Bill of Rights and freedom of speech. We would not have an Official Secrets Act, which Britain does have. Nevertheless, the issue arose of whether the war was legal. Actually, the chief of staff of their armed forces demanded an assurance from the top legal officers of the government, and the attorney general was more or less political lawyer named Goldsmith, Peter Goldsmith. He needed an assurance that this war would be legal. According to Elizabeth Wilmshurst, the top legal foreign service officer, professional foreign service officer dealing with legal matters under political appointees, gave the opinion in the government and since that without UN authorization, it would be flatly illegal. And she revealed that Goldsmith, in his original discussions with her, totally agreed with her. So when they asked for an opinion then by Goldsmith, according to her, and it finally leaked out, Goldsmith said, without UN authorization, it would be illegal. This was shared before it came out with American authorities and said, that is not acceptable. You know, if you're going to be an ally in this war, which they were, go back to the drawing board on that one. So he came up with a second written opinion, rather lengthy, saying, well, here are the case that it would be legal, and here's the case that it wouldn't be legal, where the case of illegality was, you know, obviously very much heavier than any argument that could be made that it was legal. But he sort of said, on the one hand this, and on the other hand that. that was still not good enough for the commander-in-chief, not the commander-in-chief, but the chief of staff. And he said, I do not want to be in a cell next to Slobodan Milosevic. Now, do you think any American official spent 1 minute thinking about whether he could be in a cell next to, not a chance. Was there an opinion by a legal officer? We haven't seen it. I would give good odds that no one was asked in America. Since the Second World War, we're the empire, or we're one of the two big empires at that time. And now we're the empire. We're beyond law. We are not constrained by this stuff. The American people have heard that for 60 years and more. And the question just doesn't arise. There's an agreement in effect with Cheney. That would just tie our hands from doing what we need to do, here or there. Don't ask us about law. I read somewhere that an American statesman said, and I've been trying to track down who it was for a long time, but I remember reading it very closely. International law is for the protection of the weak. We are not the weak. And that pretty much sums up the attitude of international law. I'm just making a contrast, though, there. But it didn't make a big difference. Britain did join us, as you may remember, because what happened then was he said, the chief of staff looked at that, and he said, that's not good enough for me to send people into combat in what looks like an illegal war without UN authorization. So Goldsmith then came back with a one-page paper, no argument, no substance, just saying, in my legal opinion, the war will be legal. At which point Elizabeth Wilmshurst resigned from the Foreign Office. And in a way that three people in the U.S. did that, and actually half a dozen Britishers did it. And she resigned, saying, I can't be part of this process because it's so clearly illegal. So it didn't stop them, but it conceivably could have, if Goldsmith's opinions had been known to the Parliament. So they were very carefully withheld for years and finally leaked out by someone, and finally were released. But, you know, at that point, we're well into the war. In other words, questions like that have the possibility of being raised and of being some restraint. On the question of Congress, I said I'm a person of hope, not a person of faith. If there's a difference there, the person of faith, I suppose, in a broad sense, not just religiously, believes we'll make it. It'll come through. Things will work out. We will prevail. The people united will never be defeated, though as a friend of mine prefers the chant, the people united will sometimes win and sometimes lose. But I can live with that piece of reality, actually. But hope, yes. The possibility is there, for example, of averting a war against Iran. And the question of legality, the question of hearings, must be raised. If we leave it to the leaders of the Democratic Party, it will not be raised either in the campaign or in investigations any more than it has up till now. There have been no hearings on Iran in either the Senate or or whether we should have a war against Iran, or what the legalities of it would be, what the prospects would be, what the consequences, which are certainly also of great importance, as well as the legality. The point, the prospects are so awful, both in Iraq and Iran, or in Vietnam, that it strengthens the case for international law, you know, in the sense we, and of course much more the Iraqis, would be so much better off if we had obeyed the law rather than freeing the president from any constraint of law. Everybody would be better off. So the possibilities for doing that, and that means pressing the now majority Democratic leaders to hold these hearings, to hold investigations which would, I would think, not only count very strongly against going to war illegally or any other way, even legally. By the way, there's pressure to come to Congress to authorize the war. Well, that's worthwhile because it would lower the chance of going to war, but far from zero. It could go to Congress and Congress could go along with it. It would be just as illegal and just as catastrophic. But Congress, and that's why they don't want to go to Congress. Pressing for it to go to Congress is in the right direction, and the other matters. No one could testify on this better than Admiral Fallon, just forced to resign at the end of this month. He doesn't want to testify, I've heard. I've been looking into this. That's all right. He should be subpoenaed. He has not fulfilled his responsibilities to his oath or to this country until he has told Congress under oath why he has opposed an attack on Iran, which everyone agrees he has for the last couple of years, why it would be disastrous, and all of that. And as I say, not only disastrous, these discussions on deadline, it reminded me, and others that I've seen. Is it deadline? Yeah. Was it deadline or frontline? Frontline, yeah. There's also a deadline. Frontline, the discussions did strike me as the discussions in the New York Times of people they asked for lessons on the fifth anniversary of the war, and Charlie Rose asked people for lessons. Almost entirely, I'm not sure, it may have been entirely by people who had supported the war, people who had shown such horrible judgment that they should be, in effect, discredited from any public commentary on these subjects until they've gone through a very strongly career of atonement somehow, or showing why they should ever be listened to again. And that includes two of the candidates for president, of course. And so horrible judgment, but it's not, and they have to defend the judgment now, 5 years later, which humanly speaking they do. The exceptions are like, and I give him credit for this, Edwards, who came stronger and stronger, not only said it was a mistake, but eventually ended up by saying, just before he was knocked out of the race, came to the position, we should be entirely out within a given period of time, I think he said 1 year, was it? And all out of there. Now, no one left in the race is proposing that. So the notion of being entirely out of our bases will not be, as things now stand, a subject of the campaign, not between Hillary and Obama, and not between either of them and McCain. There will be arguments which can be quite important of whether we should tremendously escalate, as I'm sure McCain would do, or stay at a somewhat lower level, which, by the way, is beginning to look less feasible now with what's happening in Iraq right now. McCain will make the point with some substance. What? You're going to achieve our objectives there with 70,000 troops? Look what's happening with 160,000. What it does, what's happening now, it strengthens the case for two alternatives, getting totally out or going up. Or you could say staying at 160,000, which isn't looking wonderful, but it's hard to go up with an absence of troops. But it definitely weakens the case, going down to 70,000 troops, as Obama and Hillary would do, and staying there forever. That's not looking good at the moment, as McCain will point out. So meanwhile, the case for getting out is not on the table. Not from the Democratic leaders, not from either of the Democratic candidates, not, of course, from the Republican. If it gets on the table, as it must, it will only be because we have demanded that. In the primary season, we've demanded, it ain't going to be Hillary, I think I can say pretty clearly. Obama has committed pretty much to the same level of troops as of now. I think, practically speaking, I can imagine, but it's very unlikely that he would shift that to getting out. I don't really foresee it. But the effort to do it is worthwhile. The question of attacking Iran, of putting, is on the table. Exit is off the table. Attacking Iran is on the table for the Democratic leaders, for the candidates, for the Republican candidate, on the table. All options must be on the table, including the use of tactical nuclear weapons against underground sites in Iran. Now, all of the current candidates have endorsed that must be on the table. An option to initiate first use of nuclear war against a country that has not attacked us and does not have nuclear weapons? That's not an option. That's not a legitimate alternative. That is nothing but a crime against humanity and a crime against the people. And to regard that as an option of the president is the ultimate human negation of the notion of law, possibly starting nuclear war by one man's decision, or frankly, a Congress's decision, if it comes to that. But so we've gone very far from the Constitution. It's worth getting back. Achieving the aims indicated by Wall would involve such a change from current practice as to be virtually revolutionary. Though in a more historical sense, it's restorative. It's, you could say, counter-revolutionary, or it's conservative. It's going back to conserving the principles, but it's radical changes. It will not and cannot be achieved by violence. A violent revolution, as in 1776, will not get us there. Fortunately, our leaders then, our founders of our Constitution, did provide for restraints here on the executive that did not require violent revolution. They're called impeachment, legislation, prosecution, and public movements with the freedom of association, politics. The freedom of speech isn't much good if there's going to be no speech during the campaign about Iran, about torture. Watch for that. Didn't get mentioned in 2004, despite the fact that the Abu Ghraib photos came out in April, well before the election campaign in 2004. I don't believe the word torture was uttered by either candidate, including, of course, Kerry, who had been at the Winter Soldier hearings back in 1971. And never mentioned, because the American people didn't care. And that was perhaps true. What we have to stand for here in terms of our political activity is to remind Congress of their oath to the Constitution, but also they are not there for the sole absolute, they were not elected for the sole absolute purpose of getting reelected. And when they say, if I were to raise this issue, that would not help my election chances, which could be true, although it's not clear, you know, really. Being totally wishy-washy and passive and standing for nothing is not doing wonders for the Democratic electoral possibilities either. That's why their standing in the polls is so low in Congress. But it's not clear that it would help them. And it's not clear that being against torture would help them, or even against attacking Iran. And yet, they are there. Their oath is not to get reelected. And I come back, it's an oath. Well, since the oath is to the U.S. Constitution, not to the Carl Schmitt Constitution, that's worth holding them to and reminding them when they fail it, as the Democratic leaders, Pelosi and others, Jay Rockefeller in the Senate with his immunity to, and by the way, I want to give Pelosi and the Progressive Caucus credit for standing up to the Senate and the President on the telephone immunity clause, business of telephone immunity. And that is 100, I've been following this, looking into it, I'll just say, that is 100% the result of grassroots pressure on them. So that was a success. Let's be aware we do have a success. And it's a useful one, very important one. So let's not flatter our powers that we can do this for sure and so forth. In the sense, let's be aware of what they realistically are, which is not very far from omnipotent or controlling the policy. Yes, the piece of paper says that we have this power. They said Congress has this power, but Congress doesn't act on it. We have the choice to act on it. And the reason I'm here today is I admire the efforts of the Warren Law League to focus on these issues for the last almost 40 years. And I want to take every chance to commend them for that and to be part of that effort. And thank you for being here. A simple investigative hearing. And of course, they're not supposed to perjure themselves. That doesn't mean that the witnesses who come forward who are subpoenaed and come forward will tell the truth. It does mean that they're subject in theory to perjury charges. But it does mean that the administration cannot order people not to come. That's very important, because the purpose of whether it's impeachment hearings or investigative hearings into crimes of the government, which John Conyers has talked about, I was in a meeting where he talked about that, having them, said he would have them, but haven't happened yet. Investigative hearings on crimes that may have been committed, fine. That's would point almost inevitably to impeachment, and that will make them just as leery of holding those hearings as they are of impeachment hearings. But if you did hold the impeachment hearings, you could get these people, and he could not order people, as Bush has done, not to appear. And the importance of that is there are people who would love to tell the truth if they are subpoenaed, and if they can't be fired for appearing. And those are the people to get. Not that I personally don't. A friend of mine is very anxious to see Cheney under oath. I said, I wouldn't give a dime for that. You know, I don't. Cheney, the chance of getting the truth out of Cheney under oath is, you know, just negligible. But there are a lot of people who would be happy to tell if they were pressed to do it. And it so happens, I've agreed to go, it now appears at my own expense, that wasn't the original idea, pay my own travel, to go to New Hampshire on later this month to be at a rally on impeachment before, 2 days before, the New Hampshire legislature votes on an impeachment measure. And by the Jefferson Manual, named after for Jefferson, of constitutional procedures, if a legislature votes impeachment, that has to be considered by the House as a, quote, privileged motion, whatever that means. I'm not sure what that, I don't know all the details of what that means, but I think it means that it has to come to a vote or to hearings. It can't be bottled up by the leadership. Anyway, they're doing it, and it seems like a worthwhile thing to do. Conceivably, if New Hampshire does do that, which I wouldn't do it if there was a 1% chance of that happening, but actually, there's a pretty fair chance, apparently, that they will actually do that, and if they did that, other legislatures could come aboard, too. It's been raised. And I think it is worthwhile. Keeping in mind, as of now, before the hearings, it's very clear you couldn't get conviction in the Senate, and what's more in the minds of the Democratic leaders, you would get a lot of opposition among the Democrats in Congress, especially the so-called Blue Dog Democrats, or Democrats in name only, that were elected and it gave them their majority this last time. So a lot of them would be against that. Though it's interesting, Nancy Pelosi got the Blue Dogs mostly to vote against immunity, though they had earlier said they would vote for immunity. Now, I'm very interested, and I'm trying to find out how that happened, see how we can do it again, why wasn't it done before, you know, and what's going on here. But it was possible to turn them around on that, and again, public pressure was crucial on that. And the Blue Dog's behavior on that threw the Wall Street Journal into a paroxysm of hysteria, practically, an editorial. These people are traitors. How could they have done that? And they printed in their editorial columns the names of every Blue Dog Democrat. They don't usually admit, you know, for Democrats, who had voted that way. Some more questions.
Yeah, you know, Nancy Pelosi is our representative.
I'm aware of that. That's why I mentioned her. Yeah. So that means that's a responsibility of yours. She has to listen to you a lot more than she'll listen to people from other parts of the country. And if pressure can be brought, and this is one case, really the first in a year, where I would say on this area of national security, where Nancy Pelosi deserves to be told now, that was right, you did that right, thank you, do it again, use your power to protect the Constitution. Which she hasn't been doing. Yes, of course.
And it was eventually, tabling was stopped by a couple of the Republicans, and there was referred to the Judiciary Committee, where it now sits. But I wanted to make another comment. It seems to me the only way to bring discussion of complete withdrawal from Iraq and no war in Iran is to support Ralph Nader. He's the one person
to
be on the other direction. What are your answers?
How many interested? Obviously, a number of people agree with that. Could I just see hands? How many people agree with that point here? How many do not, let's say? Interesting. Okay, well, that's both sides are represented here. I could talk a long time on that, but I won't. I'll forego. Let me put it in a positive way. In my opinion, there is a very constructive, helpful, valuable way for a third-party run, specifically for Ralph Nader's run, to be to do good for the country, be good for the country. Very much in his power, it was in the year 2000, 2004. He chose not to do it, could do it now. And let's say third party in general. One slightly broader context. As I often said in 2000 and again in 2004, I not only admire Nader very much for his pre-2000, you know, unreservedly his before 2000, all the efforts he made for this country and for consumers, and not only consumers, for lots of things. I admired him unreservedly. And in the campaign, I could say, I could agree, now give my position, I could agree with everything he was saying, except when he said, vote for me in swing states, in swing states. Now, the way, what he could have done, as many people urged him to do, including Michael Moore and others, and actually as he said he would do to donors early in 2000, that he could have run hard in 45 states, let's say, saying, vote against both these turkeys by voting for me and show constituents. And in the 5, 6, 7 clearly predictable close states, he could have said, vote against Bush by voting for Gore or Kerry. Now, what kept him from doing that, of course, one thing that went against his rhetoric to this extent. His position was, and most third parties do this, but they don't have to, was to say there is no difference. And then if people really pressed him, he'd say, well, no significant difference, no difference that makes any difference between the two parties, and between the two leaders, let's say. I would say that that was flat wrong, and I give Ralph Nader enough credit. I'll say this bluntly here and make some of you angry. I'll say I believe that he was lying when he said that. And he was saying it because that's what he thought third-party candidates have to do, and he had to, in response, there's no difference. You don't have to say that. You can say that I agreed totally with his criticisms of the Democratic Party. I wouldn't, and the leadership, and the leaders, and Obama, and Hillary, and Gore, and Kerry, everything he said in criticism, I think, is absolutely right. To say that Bush was no worse, or that McCain was no worse, is not only foolish and monumentally bad judgment, but false. And it showed me, and I don't think personally, I used to say, if Ralph Nader can, by the pressures of a campaign process and your subordinates and everybody else pressing, can come to say stuff like that during a campaign, I wouldn't trust myself not to do it either. I wouldn't trust myself not to lie like that or to dissimulate like that in the campaign. It shows what a campaign will do to you. It still remains the case that he could very well now say he wouldn't have to temper his criticism of Obama or Hillary in the slightest. And I didn't when it came to Kerry. I said in 2004, I do not believe Kerry will get us out of Iraq. And I do not believe, as I just said, Obama will get us out of Iraq or Hillary Clinton. That's a terribly discredited, you know, terrible thing to have to say. But that's what I believe. But that it makes no difference if it's McCain or Obama, that's absurd. So when you come to the point now of a Florida or an Ohio or somewhere like that, it's, I think, doing the country a very great disservice at that point in the campaign, the last few weeks in the campaign, when you know which states make the difference, to say, okay, I'm going to use my influence to get people who would otherwise vote for the Democrat. And of course, there are some who wouldn't vote otherwise. But there are a lot of people who would otherwise vote for the Democrat to vote for me and have the effect of electing the Republican. And by the way, that wouldn't always be as serious. I'll be very flat. Between George H.W. Bush and Clinton, there wasn't anything like the difference that we're talking about now. The possibility for a third party effort then, which might have thrown it to George H.W. Bush, who was also a war criminal. But the difference between him and Clinton as a war criminal is not all that great in many cases. But the difference between Gore and George W. Bush, or either of the Democrats and George and McCain, to dispute that and to say, I will work in a swing state so as to elect, have the effect of electing a Republican, is, I think, not good politics. But could we carry that on further? To elect McCain will not advance the anti-war movement.
No, he won't elect McCain. Nader has absolutely no chance. He may have an effect in talking and bringing that issue up.
No, bringing the issues up is, I'm all for it. And I'm saying there's a way to do it. And by the way, he's going to run. So pressure on Nader to run, in my opinion, in the way I've described, is an altogether positive, constructive contribution to the process. To get someone to raise these issues, as I've said, since the departure of Kucinich and Gravel and Ron Paul, in effect, and Richardson and Edwards, there is no voice in the campaign for exit. So, of course, to have a voice in the campaign is very worthwhile. And but one can do that without pretending that it has no effect. It depends on the state. It depends on the timing. It depends on where things are. Possibly there will be no swing states by November. Maybe one or the other will be, you know, just clear. In that case, it's not an issue. But if there's a swing state, then, as I was discussing with somebody earlier, you can say it's a choice between imperialists, but it can make a difference which imperialist is in, and McCain is not the one I want to see in.
Dr. Elmer.
Yeah. Maybe just
feeling,
one. What?
I have the feeling we're keeping you here too much.
No, it's all right. I'll take one more.
Take one more.
One more in back there. Yeah.
Okay.
Would you like to come speak into the mic, too, because it's
yeah.
More recording can't hear the question.
Please come up to the microphone.
Come up to the microphone.
Yes, you.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll speak loudly.
Okay.
Very well be mistaken, but my impression was that Obama is saying that he would get us out of Iraq as responsibly as opposed to the irresponsible way that we went in, but he would still get us out, I think he said within a year. Hillary is saying that she would begin immediate withdrawal within 60 days, but she would do it with great care. So I don't see that as either one of them saying that we're going to continue, without...
No, neither. Thank you for raising that. It's a very important point. Neither has said we will continue forever. But they have described missions that they propose to maintain in Iraq without either of them putting a figure themselves personally on how many troops will be involved. But others have looked at those missions, and each of them has talked about maintaining borders, training Iraqi troops, you know, and the question is which Iraqi troops and whose side are they on exactly. Neither of them has given any hint they would take bases out of Iraq. They will defend the bases, they will defend the embassy. Defending the embassy takes more than a squad of Marines. And Richardson said it very pungently, he said, I'll take all the troops out except the Marines guarding the enemy, the embassy, and if they're fired on, I take them out, which means you take the embassy out. And of course, Barbara Lee has four times apparently put forward resolutions that actually pass no permanent bases, to which the response of the administration, which is good, but the administration has simply changed the name. No permanent bases? We don't have permanent bases anywhere. Enduring bases, I mean, you don't want them, you don't want the roof leaking within weeks, you know, and so forth, or within 50 years. So I would ask, with the missions that each of them has described, and this is my best understanding of both of their positions. Another question is, what will they do once they're in? That's a fair question. What they say is only one piece of evidence as to what they'll actually do, and it's far from conclusive. But in terms of what they say, it's very close. And close to what? Close to the Baker Commission, close to others, which definitely involve keeping enduring bases there, essentially forever. So they may not pretend with McCain that when he says 50 to 100 years, or he's going on 1,000 years, a million years, a million years is not the problem because the oil will have run out long before that. Even 1,000 years, you don't have to worry about 100 maybe. But the 100 years is not a bad prediction. And McCain says, well, what I meant was not fighting, of course. I meant achieving an Iraq in which we will have bases and we'll be there, but no one will be shooting at us. Well, that is not going to happen. But being there is going to happen. Now, McCain's way of making that happen, I'm sure, is to bomb more, put more troops in, maybe a draft if necessary, would be necessary, and, you know, go up, escalate. I would ask, and I say as voters here, we all ought to be asking Obama and Hillary Clinton, something they've refused to say, under your notion of the continuing, persistent missions that we must maintain, just when would you imagine troops being out? Now, both of them have, and they say, well, who can be sure, you know, exactly. Why would it be less than 50 years? Or 100 years. Do you really foresee that we'll have the peaceful Iraq in 10 years? And what if we don't? Wouldn't your considerations still apply? I think that Obama and Hillary are both in the fine print promising us that it is their intention, which they might or might not carry out, their intention to stay in those bases forever, as long as McCain would. And they could change that. They could say what Edwards said. They could say what Kucinich or Gravel or Ron Paul all said. Those words can be uttered by a politician. Granted, those politicians are not with us anymore. They didn't get the contributions. They didn't get the media support. They didn't get the support of the leaders of their party. Popular support? It wasn't a popular rejection of those ideas that put any of those people out of the race. And it would be popular enough. But here's a case where the Constitution can't override, you know, the interests of people in keeping those bases in the oil-rich Middle East. And so unless you buckle up to the idea of saying we eschew the determination to control the oil contracts of Iraq, to control who is the government of Iraq, to control whether it is pro-Israel or pro-US, if those are requirements as it is now, forever. And those are the requirements now. Now, that's not with the public demand, and the public is confused and they're ignorant and they haven't heard much about it. But I think that's a situation where conceivably we could change the rhetoric on that.